Hello, and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your guest host, Moises Chiu-Yan, and my guest today is your regular host, Anthony Johnston. Anthony, welcome back to the slash your show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Hello.
I was delighted to be invited to keep your seat warm as you yourself defended a wonderful film. Why don't you tell us what you have come to your own show to defend today?
Right. Well, and just before I do, I'll remind everyone that this is now becoming an annual tradition where it's my birthday. Basically, this is the episode that comes out around my birthday. So as part of the inspiration for the show was because, you know, there are so many things that I believe are unjustly maligned that, yeah, I take this opportunity around my birthday to basically step up to the mic and do something myself because I can. It's my show, even if you're hosting it this week. So, I am here to defend. See, I could do nothing but music. I did music last year, and I could do nothing but music, frankly, and still be here in like 2050. But I figured that people hear me yak enough about music already on various other shows, including The Incomparable and Thrash It Out and stuff. So I thought, well, let's do a different medium. And so today I am going to explain the joy, the magnificence, the awesomeness that is the 1998 movie Dark City, directed by Alex Proyas and starring Rufus Sewell, Kiefer Sutherland, and Jennifer Connelly. And I adore this movie. I loved it the moment I saw it in the theatres when it was first released. And still love it to this day. I've rewatched it many, many times.
Now, is this love born in an interest in some of the things that very notably inspired the visual look and the psychological underpinnings of the movie, German expressionist films like Nosferatu, that sort of thing? Was it very much playing to things that you already loved?
To an extent, yeah. I mean, there's definitely some of that. It is, as you say, visually. I mean, it's basically a sci-fi film noir. And visually, it takes a lot of cues from, yes, things like German Expressionism, Nosferatu, Cabinet of Totsu Caligari, M, even Proyas has specifically said that M was an influence on it. And of course, you know, film noir itself and, you know, Humphrey Bogart movies, even stuff like that, which I love. And it's it's also a murder mystery, a detective story, which I love. And it's sci-fi. So it was just kind of everything wrapped up in a big bundle that I love and then done really, really well and with a great story, a great mystery, great performances, you know, from everyone. But also, I don't know, it's just there's something about movies like this. All of my favorite movies are mysteries. Like, you know, pretty much without exception, apart from, I'm not counting things like Miyazaki and sort of like, you know, sort of, or Disney movies, that sort of, but, you know, mature adult movies, almost all of my favorite movies are mysteries of one form or another, like Seven or The Usual Suspects or Blade Runner, which is, you know, itself still a mystery. And this, there's something about that kind of the slow unraveling of a mystery, peeling back all the layers, throwing you in somewhere in media res so that you're completely and utterly bewildered and confused. And you're like, what is going on? Where am I? What is this place? What's happening? And then you have to kind of put it all together over the course of the movie. You, the audience, have to figure out what's going on along with the characters as they figure it out. And then inevitably the big revelation at the end, although one of the things I love about this movie is that there's about three big revelations in turn at the end. They're just, all of that is, I don't want to call it a formula, but it's pretty close to a formula for my ideal movie. And then, yeah, combine it with the visual style of a movie like this. And Alex Proyas is, you know, is a wonderfully visual director. And as I say, some great performances by some, you know, some of my favorite actors. Yeah, just absolutely love everything about this movie, from the influences to what came out of the other side of it.
Well, with a movie where we have a cityscape that's constantly being re-sculpted and reshaped, something that we see as a visual motif in plenty of things, from The Matrix to Inception to the upcoming Doctor Strange as of its last trailer, where we have all kinds of craziness going on visually. I find it interesting that this film itself, we have a movie about reiterating reality that has its own two separate realities, the original theatrical cut and the director's cut. And what I find most interesting in a world of movies that the director has come out and their director's cut really, to me, has ended up being superior to the original theatrical version. The original theatrical version is not nearly as compromised as you would expect, going into it thinking of it as, well, this is something that they required some more didacticism. They wanted a voiceover narration at the beginning. They wanted this. They wanted that. I find it fascinating that even through the various studio strictures that he was given, Proyas still ended up with a movie that in its original cut was so good, completely unlike, say, Terry Gilliam's original cut of Brazil versus the theatrical version that they wanted him to release.
Absolutely, yeah. I agree completely. I mean, I was, as I say, like absolutely struck by this movie when I first saw it, and that was the theatrical release. So, yes, the theatrical release is a compromise, but it is nowhere near... You know, it's not like it's a terrible, terrible movie or anything until you get to the director's cut. It's still a really great movie. That said, I do prefer the director's cut, partly because it credits the audience with a bit more intelligence. It removes the voiceover. Well, it removes the voiceover, but it turns out that the voiceover that starts this movie, we'll have to describe the plot for listeners because most people probably haven't seen it in a bit, but I'll just say that...
We're setting them up for the mind bending.
Right, yeah. The voiceover that starts the theatrical cut is actually taken from towards the end of the regular movie when Kiefer Sutherland's character is basically laying it all out and explaining the first of the big revelations.
First, there was darkness. Then came the strangers. They abducted us and brought us here. This city, everyone in it, is their experiment. They're dying, you see. Their entire race is on the brink of extinction. They think we can save them.
So it is a voiceover, but it's not like it was information or even dialogue that wasn't already in the movie, unlike, say, the voiceover in Blade Runner, which doesn't appear, you know, was only written specifically for that voiceover. That's not the case with the voiceover, and I think that helps make it, you know, not so bad. And like I say, I fell in love with this movie from the theatrical release, so, you know, it certainly can't have been that bad. I'm really glad that you mentioned Inception, actually, because that's another of my favorite movies, and I know Inception really divides people, but I think it is a wonderful piece of cinema. Not quite, you know, on the level of something like this or Usual Suspects or whatever, in my opinion, but I do think it's a wonderful, you know, and thoroughly sort of modern sci-fi existentialist movie, which frankly we don't get many of these days. I don't think we ever did, but we certainly don't these days.
There was a time when the director of The Crow would make a movie like this, or director Steven Soderbergh would make a movie like Kafka,
yes,
which has been, I think, tremendously sadly forgotten, but he's allegedly been working on remastering and recutting, and they're going to do a DVD or something like that.
That's one of my favorite things about Christopher Nolan, is that he is one of the few directors left who's doing that, who's doing the sort of, okay, I'll make a big thing for you, you know, a big sort of massive blockbusting movie that somebody else sort of gives to me, and I'll make that for you, but then I'm going to go and make my own thing because I've got enough clout to get this strange, quirky, original movie made, despite the fact that, you know, you'd rather that I make a sequel to this other big blockbuster thing. I love the fact that he does that. And yeah, not all of them are... Or they're not always successful, you know. I'm not saying that every movie he's made is perfect, but you look at his career and he's one of the few people in the last 15 years or so who's doing that kind of thing. And I think that alone is, you know, very admirable. Unlike, it must be said, Alex Proyas's recent output, which is not great. he's a man who really, you know, you read interviews with him, and he really seems to have been beaten down by the system, which is a great shame, I think. So, okay, let's quickly explain the premise.
We wake up with our protagonist, played by Rufus Sewell, who I've decided is ageless, because you look at him in this and you look at him in The Man in the High Castle, and it's like he's not aged a day.
Right, right. He was in a British, set in Italy, but British-made detective series a few years ago as well, called Zen, based on a series of books. And again, yeah, he looked exactly the same. Didn't look like it aged a day. It was ridiculous. So yeah, he wakes up in a bathtub, bleeding from his head, in the bath, completely naked, with a swinging light bulb, throwing lovely expressionist shadows everywhere, and is clearly disorientated and confused. There's no dialogue in it, but he's obviously like, what the hell's going on? And ostensibly, the movie is all about him trying to figure out how he got there and why he was there. But as he does that, the whole thing becomes much stranger, and he stumbles out into the street and everybody's asleep. Like, the entire city seems to be asleep at midnight. And then suddenly they all wake up again and act as if nothing had happened. And this happens several times, and he doesn't fall asleep, but everybody else does. He's being pursued by strange, pale, bald men in black leather trench coats and hats who clearly want him dead, and he might be a serial killer who's lost his memory, and he's been missing for 3 weeks, and his wife is like gone to the police and filed a missing persons report. It is very confusing. It's like, what on earth is going on here? The detective is played by William Hurt, played magnificently by William Hurt.
Mrs. Murdoch, why didn't you report this before? I mean, if your husband has been missing as long as you say.
I thought he'd simply walked out on me. Then the doctor contacted me this evening.
How long have you been married?
Nearly 4 years. Why do you ask?
Because you seem uncomfortable with your ring, as if you were unaccustomed to wearing it.
Oh, I never take it off.
Do these names mean anything to you?
No. Who are these women? Why are you looking for my husband? Are you going to accuse him of something?
Maybe. Maybe murder.
Whose murder? Which one?
All of them.
And he is not only trying to catch this serial killer, but also dealing with his old partner who's gone insane and thinks that there's all this big conspiracy and that nothing is real and reality itself is meaningless.
You're scaring your wife to death, Eddie.
She's not my wife. I don't know who she is. I don't know who any of us are.
What makes you say that?
You think about the past much, Frank?
How much is the next guy?
See, I've been trying to remember things, clearly remember things from my past. But the more I try to think back, the more it all starts to unravel. None of it seems real. It's like I've just been dreaming this life, and when I finally wake up, I'll be somebody else. Somebody totally different.
You saw something, didn't you, Eddie? Something to do with the case.
There is no case. There never was. It's all just a big joke. It's a joke.
Which, as a viewer, you come to realize throughout the course of the movie is that he's actually right. Like, he is insane, but he's also right. And you're just waiting for the other characters to try and figure out exactly what's all behind it and see if they can cope with it with that knowledge, without going insane. And then, again, as events unfold, you realize that these strange pale men in black trench coats, led by, well, not led, but the people pursuing the character are led by Richard O'Brien, again, in a wonderful role that was actually written for him, apparently. And you can kind of see that.
So it seems you've discovered your unpleasant nature.
How are you?
We might ask the same question. Yes. Sleep. Now.
They are actually aliens. They have strange powers. They can alter reality. When he kills one of them, this strange glowing tentacled creature crawls out of the guy's head. It's all very strange. And then John, the River Seals character, John Murdoch, discovers somehow that he has some limited form of these same reality altering powers. And I mean, if that sounds confusing, like I say, it is a genuinely confusing movie at first, but it relies on you watching, paying attention to everything that happens, every line of dialogue, everything that every character does is important. That's another thing I love about this movie, and one of the, you know, a thing that will make me generally like a movie is when nothing is wasted, nothing is superfluous or unnecessary. And if you pay attention to everything that happens, you will be rewarded by understanding exactly what the hell is going on at the end.
It rewards attention in a way that we're not used to in the age of second screen entertainment, where people watch, they'll quote unquote watch a movie, they'll play a video game, they'll have a YouTube video going simultaneously. This is a movie that you have to actually pay attention to. It's the sort of thing that I'll occasionally see someone live tweeting a movie that they're watching for the first time. And for any movie, I feel like, what are you doing? What are you doing to yourself?
Right, for the first time. Yeah, that's crazy.
But in particular, I rue the day that I see someone doing that for this movie, because I don't see how you watch this movie and not give it all of your attention, which in 1998, there were much fewer ways that you could distract yourself. I mean, you could walk into the cinema with a book, I guess, or or a digital watch set for, to have its alarm go off in the middle of the screening. But you didn't have smartphones, and you didn't have other distractions to take you away from it while watching it at home. One of the things that I think stands the test of time best with this film is that it really does arrest your attention. It earns it, and it doesn't give you many breaths of opportunity to stray elsewhere at all.
Right, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned second screen. But yeah, that wasn't a thing back when this was released. And yet, people were still confused. People still weren't paying enough attention to it. And you can see that just in the reviews. And not just the reviews, but, you know, sort of public reaction. But the reviews and critics, especially so many critics, said that this movie looked amazing, but made no sense. Or, you know, was all style over substance, which was one of their favorite criticisms of the day. And that's just, it's absolutely absurd. I've said this before, and I can't actually remember which movie I was talking about now, but I've said this before on this show. It really infuriates me when people say that about sci-fi movies, especially sci-fi and fantasy movies, because there is a sort of undercurrent of, oh, it's just a sci-fi movie, or, oh, it's just a fantasy movie. I don't need to pay attention. I don't need to give this my full attention. I can just sort of sit here and switch my brain off and be entertained and whatever. And then when those same people are completely confused by something, they say, oh, it doesn't make sense. Rather than obviously, you know, be embarrassed and admit that actually they just weren't paying enough attention. And you only seem to see that with genre movies. Oh, it was Jupiter Ascending that I said it about. Yeah, back when I talked about that with Serenity in an earlier episode. And it really infuriates me, because it's always genre movies that people say this about. And it's like, no, if you just actually paid attention, if you treated this as a movie worth your time, like you would any other movie that wasn't sci-fi or fantasy, you would realize that actually it's a very elegantly constructed, complex, but nevertheless clear story that requires you, as you said, to sort of, you know, to be engaged and to be attentive to.
One of the things that, flipping through the various reviews that are thankfully archived by the people at Rotten Tomatoes, a site that I don't generally like, except for the purpose of being able to aggregate things of the past in this way, not in giving things an actual, I guess you would say, mathematical score as to whether it's worth anything or not.
Right, right.
Are the comments like, Proyas has perhaps unconsciously created an allegory of his own industry, a manufacturer of banal dreams, emotional cliches, hackneyed artifacts, and high-tech hoo-ha, designed to conceal the vacancy within and without. Comments like that, slamming the movie for
from critics who would go on to say that The Matrix was this grand, uncompromised genius that wasn't derivative at all, that was this original vision and everything. And The Matrix itself, something that people bring up in the same breath as this movie a lot of the time, often not understanding the timelines of how movies are made or the fact that Dark City was something that Proyas had been working on going back to college. It's stunning to me, just juxtaposing the ridiculously, I'll say, banal, cliche, and hackneyed things that people said about this film that could technically be said the same about The Matrix, were they not, I guess, wowed by it being pitched as the next big thing. Whereas this movie was released by New Line, it was a smaller release. It was something that was not given nearly the kind of ramp up, lead up sort of anticipation as The Matrix was.
Right. Yeah. The Matrix, man. And don't get me wrong, I love The Matrix, or the first movie at any rate.
I wasn't aware they'd made other movies, but go on.
Yeah, exactly. But it is such a shame that this film basically got screwed by the reaction to The Matrix, not by The Matrix itself. Obviously, as you say, the way film production works, you know, the movies were basically being made at the same time. The Matrix actually released in 1999, the year after this. But there's no question that both movies were in production, both in Australia as well, funnily enough, at the same time. So there's no question of, like, you know, rip-off or anything like that.
Warner Brothers looked at the two films and said, well, this one is our blockbuster, this is the one that, well, this guy's asking for more money and we don't really like him, so let's screw him.
Right, and this one's our blockbuster and this one isn't. This one is our sort of slightly complicated, confusing, doesn't screen test very well.
This guy's not trying to deliver us a franchise in any respect.
Right. It's such a shame. I remember when, because like I say, I loved this movie from the moment I saw it, and I told all my friends about it, and I would tell anyone who would listen, like, you've got to go and see this movie. And then, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months later, when The Matrix was sort of gearing up for all its big PR push, and somebody said, like, oh, because at the time I was working at a magazine publisher, which had a few things like, you know, movie and pop culture magazines and stuff. And I remember somebody describing The Matrix to me, saying, oh, there's this movie coming out called The Matrix. It's got such a great premise. It's blah, blah, blah. And they described it to me, and I was like, that sounds very close to Dark City, in fact. Now, obviously, the movies are very much not at all alike, but if you just describe them in very, very sort of broad overview terms, they are quite similar in that they both deal with, yes, somebody realizing that reality is not what it seems, and, you know, sort of
all tentacly alien things.
Right. And all powerful entities are in charge of our reality, and you've got to wake up and realize that you're not living in the real world. You know, that sort of thing. When you speak in those very vague, broad terms, they do sound very similar. But of course, they're not at all. The Matrix is, and like I say, I'm not knocking it because I do like The Matrix, but The Matrix is basically an action movie that happens to be about, well, it asks the question, if you realize that the world you're living in is safe but false, would you instead choose to live in a real but dangerous world? Fair enough. You know, it's good premise, nice and philosophical. Dark City, on the other hand, is if it's more about what it means to be human. It is it's nature versus nurture, I suppose, you know. And specifically, if you have the fake memories of a serial killer, will you then continue to kill, or is there something deeper in our nature, in our psyche, in, if you like, our soul, something deeper beyond experience, something innate that makes us who we are, that relies on more than just memory and experience, which is a less tangible, but I think much more interesting question to ask. It is much deeper, you know, sort of much more deeply concerned about the nature of what it means to be human.
One of the beautiful things about the movie is that it doesn't shy away from any of that kind of intensely deep psychological analysis. And this implanting of fake memories motif is something that we see reused in popular media since then, sometimes very expertly, sometimes not so expertly by people. The most recent example of it brings me to your world of comic books, where Nick Spencer has employed this as the big struggle for Captain America. If Captain America thinks that he has been an agent of Hydra, that he's an agent of evil going back to when he was a child, is he going to eventually break from that, or is he going to is his nature not strong enough to overcome that? And it's something that I'm sort of amazed more people haven't ripped it off. One of the just general thematic things that I like so much about the film that differentiates it from The Matrix, which again I like very much. A lot of the iconography of The Matrix is very generic, and the iconography in Dark City is very specific, down to references to the feel of Edward Hopper paintings, the German Expressionist films that it draws from, where this one, I guess, if I have to choose, makes me a Dark City guy versus a Matrix guy, which is one of those intensely nerdy debates that you get into with friends.
Yeah.
it's really in that specificity. It's that it owns the things that it's drawing off of, that it's referencing, that it's going after, because that's the very core part of the narrative. It matters so intensely to this film, and it matters not really at all to The Matrix. And it's one of the reasons that I at first I didn't really like The Matrix that much. I mean, it didn't grab me and arrest me in the way that this one did. And in the early days of DVD, I felt I had to have the cardboard snapper case New Line DVD of this as one of the first three DVDs I got, and I could frankly wait on The Matrix. I'd be fine.
It wasn't one of the first three that I got, but I had that same cardboard snapper case, yes. What I love about the aesthetic in this, you're right, it is very specific, it owns all of its influences, but even that is part of, as you say, the narrative. All of that is part of the story. It has this beautiful noir aesthetic, everything's dark, the streets are all rain-slicked. You have, as you said, this sort of callback to Edward Hopper paintings in the lighting, lots of street lights and naturalistic lighting, shadows everywhere. It's perpetual night. That's the other thing that's confusing about the city, of course, in Dark City, is that it's never day. It just seems to exist forever in night, which is, you know, very confusing. And all of that visual is, it's like a sort of 1940s noir nostalgia, but it's not quite right. You look at the subway scenes, they're clearly not 1940s. They're more like 1970s, like, you know, stuff like, I don't know, The French Connection, or, you know, that kind of aesthetic. Some of the styles of dress are actually even more modern. Some of the styles of dress are actually even older than the 1940s. But it all kind of, in the same way that actually a lot of classic Batman visual stuff, you know, makes the modern day look as if fashions and styles never really got beyond Art Deco. This does a similar sort of thing. The difference is that that's actually part of the story. That is part of the narrative, because it's all based on memories. It's not based on realities or real experience. It's based on human memories of what that time was like by people, many of whom never actually lived through it. And I love that. I love that you can have an idiot. I mean, it looks gorgeous from the very first opening frame right to the end. The whole film just does look amazing. But there is so much substance underneath that style. And part of that is that, yeah, the way it looks is an essential part of the story. And that is kind of the icing on the cake for me.
One of the things that might stick out to some people in the quote-unquote early age of CG that this comes from is some of the effects that don't quite photoreal mesh as I guess, well as certain things do these days. But that actually lent a bit to the surreality of the world in which this movie lives. It didn't take me out of it. It felt slightly ill-fitting, and I think that was a good thing at the end of the day. If it were too seamless, the world of the real to the world of the unreal that was created in a computer, I think would actually bother me.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it did. One thing I do remember about the theatrical version is the very end, there is a kind of a CGI battle, if you like, or a battle that has lots of CGI in it. And I do remember at the time thinking, oh, that's a bit ropey. And they have cleaned that up actually quite a bit on the special edition. And I'm actually glad that they did, because it still doesn't look perfect. I mean, the special edition was still done using 2005 technology. So, you know, to our modern eyes now, it still doesn't look as perfect as something like, you know, a modern day superhero blockbuster with its basically perfect CGI recreations of everything from, you know, machines to people.
Yeah, well, you say perfect, and some of that stuff looks like rubber action figures being thrown at one another.
Well, some of it, but I mean, the better stuff, you know, the point is that with enough time and care, we now have the ability to basically do everything except convincingly animate Jeff Bridges' face. But apart from that, deep cut. But apart from that, we have the ability to animate almost everything to a point where you cannot tell whether or not it's real, and certainly to composite everything seamlessly, whereas in 1998, they didn't. And you can tell that in some places. But like you say, I don't think it doesn't really take me out of the movie, but I am glad that they cleaned some of it up for the director's edition, because I do remember some of those effects in the theatrical version being, you know, a little too ropey enough that they did actually take you out of the movie, which is a great shame, because one of the things this movie does is draw you in. It immerses you. The world building in it is so effective and so seamless. And again, the performances from all of the actors are so great and so sort of, again, you know, they're immersed in it. They are so convincing that you do kind of get, if you let yourself, you do get sucked in to, you know, the frame of the movie. It's wonderful in that way.
It's a deeply personal movie. It lets you do this kind of ridiculous stuff with your imagination and feel it like it is just as personal as, you know, a two person, you know, play in the theater, that sort of thing. You mentioned the characters, something that I feel you have the cultural acumen to answer this better than I or any silly colonialist, us Americans would. How do you feel that this movie ranks in the history of creepy, sinister Englishman bad guys?
Oh, it's pretty high. It's pretty high, yeah. But that, again, a lot of that is helped by Richard O'Brien.
And Ian Richardson, I mean, he's no slouch.
Right, I was going to say, and of course Ian Richardson, who is just amazing. American listeners who are struggling with that name, Ian Richardson played Francis Urquhart in the original House of Cards, which most people are now at least aware of thanks to the Netflix remake. He's fantastic. He has such weight and gravitas in everything he does, and he really brings it to this role. And in this, he basically plays the leader of the strangers, who are the strange, pale, dark trench coat wearing men who control the Dark City.
Mr. Book, does he know?
Should we not know, Mr. Hand?
We had hoped to learn more before sharing with you.
We can know nothing until we possess him. Mr. Knight, you will take the east. Mr. Face, you the west. Mr. Glove, the south. Mr. Shade, the north. We must have this man.
And he's fantastic. But it's Richard O'Brien, because he has so much more screen time. It's Richard O'Brien who really gets that creepiness across, and he does it so well. And yeah, apparently Proyas specifically wrote that role for Richard O'Brien with him in mind, because he was such an admirer of O'Brien as Riff Raff in Rocky Horror, because who isn't?
And I think, honestly, Richard O'Brien was a bigger entry point or drawing point for those few of us who saw this theatrically relative to other movies. I think there are a lot of us Rocky Horror nuts who came out to see this movie because it was Richard O'Brien, you know, being creepy in something. And we'd heard about that. And that was a reason for us to get up and go out to the theater.
I was actually quite lucky in that I went into this not knowing a lot about it. I'm not even sure if I knew Richard O'Brien was in it. I may have done, but I don't recall that being a major factor of why I decided to see it. And I'd certainly never heard of Rufus Sewell before.
Oh, yeah. This made me a fan of Rufus Sewell for life.
Absolutely.
But
yes.
I'd never heard of the guy before.
Yeah.
And they had, at two different points, this is something that's in the Blu-ray extras, they had potentially had Johnny Depp on the hook at one point. And then at one point, they completely shut down pre-production for 4 weeks because it looked like they might get Tom Cruise.
I didn't know that. Wow.
And I can barely imagine this movie with either of those people in that part.
Well, on the director's commentary, One of the things Preyas says when he's talking about casting Sewell was that he felt that, yes, they toyed with sort of getting recognizable name actors, but that he felt ultimately that getting somebody who was basically unknown to audiences worked better, because he was worried that there might be too much cognitive dissonance between the idea of a character, you know, a man who has no memory and doesn't know who he is, combined with, you know, or contrasted against an audience who immediately recognizes the actor playing him. And I can see that. I can understand that, because there is, you know, even in sort of roles where the actor is able to lose themselves in the role, you know, and even people like Depp and Cruz, we've seen them play roles like that. But even then, you still know that it's them. And there is that immediate, when they come on the screen, you're like, hey, there's that actor.
Yeah. I would hate for this movie to have been like the Jack Reacher franchise with Tom Cruise. And the poster is just him looking very, you know, tough and butch, you know, staring at the camera. And instead of being called Dark City, it would be called John Murdoch.
Right. yes, it would, wouldn't it? I can't imagine it either. I can't see it being as effective. But I did like the fact that they surrounded him with people that you would recognize. And I was going to say that, even though I don't recall Richard O'Brien, as I say, being a major factor in my wanting to see it, although I love Richard O'Brien and Rocky Horror, and I had no idea who Rufus Sewell was, but Kiefer Sutherland, William Hurt, and Jennifer Connelly are absolutely, you know, any one of them will make me think, oh, I might watch that. And all three of them together, just, again, you know, they're wonderful in the movie, but just the mere fact of them all being in the movie definitely had my interest, you know, made me think, okay, this is probably going to be worth seeing, because they've all had interesting careers. Not that every movie they've done has been great, but I love actors who clearly try to look for interesting films. And, you know, I would place all three of them, and Rufus Sewell actually now since this, you know, in that level of, they are clearly people who like doing interesting things, even if they may not be blockbusters, even if it's not a role that's going to get you on the cover of Time magazine or whatever, or even on Letterman, you know, but they are interesting roles for an actor, you know, from a craft point of view. Mm-hmm. And I like that about all of those actors. And yeah, this movie is definitely one of them. It gives all of them a lot to sink their teeth into. I mean, Jennifer Connelly is playing a really complex character. She kind of doesn't do a lot. She's not wasted, but, you know, her character is kind of very reactionary and a little underwritten in places. But the way she plays it is amazing, because there is such a complexity of emotion going on in her character.
I've been so worried about you. Are you punishing me? You know, if disappearing is your way of punishing me, I don't appreciate it.
I don't know what you're talking about. I found these keys in my pocket, so I assume I live here. You're supposed to be my wife.
Supposed. John, you really don't know who I am, do you? Your doctor called me. He was worried that this might happen.
My doctor?
Yeah, he. He gave me his card. He's desperate to find you.
Schreiber. I feel like I'm living out someone else's nightmare. What happened to me? Why was I seeing a doctor?
I had an affair. You were angry at me. The police are looking for you.
Oh.
And she does it so well. She just holds the screen. And William Hurt brings that lovely sort of hangdog gravitas to his role. He's just such a sad, tragic character. But again,
I mean, the cop who is really never going to solve the case that he is on.
Right. And you feel kind of knows in the back of his mind that he's never going to solve it, that he's kind of resigned to, yeah, I'm never going to solve this one, but he's still going through the motions. And what I love about the way he plays the role is that he does it with a certain stoicism, but never sort of descends into parody or cliche.
Well, and then you have Kiefer Sutherland, who many people, I think, at this point associate more with Jack Bauer than they do than I do with him playing roles in Young Guns, in The Three Musketeers that Disney did,
and Lost Boys, of course.
And Lost Boys, of course. Lost Boys is about the closest that you would get to, I guess you would say, the orbit of what it is he plays here as Dr. Schreiber, named after a real life doctor who did deep investigations into the world of schizophrenia and did a lot of breakthrough research that was dismissed at the time because just studying it, taking it seriously was ridiculous. And how could you take such a thing seriously? And of course, he suffered from it as well.
Absolutely. And one of, and Proyas has been very open that some of the books that the real Daniel Schreiber wrote were an influence on, the sort of some of the elements in this story. And one of his delusions, one of the real Dr. Schreiber's delusions, was that he was surrounded by, quote, fleeting men, which he described as souls from heaven that resided temporarily in human bodies, which, without wanting to give too much away, because I really hope people go away and watch this movie. But you and I know, is kind of relevant to this movie. So, yeah, it's fascinating. And story-wise as well, another interesting influence is there is apparently, I haven't read it, but there is apparently some influence from a novel by the Strugatsky brothers called The Doomed City. And the Strugatsky brothers, of course, best known to most people for writing Roadside Picnic, which became Tarkovsky's film Stalker. But they wrote this sci-fi novel, The Doomed City, with a kind of a similar setup, except that the inhabitants of the city were aware of what was going on and were willing participants. I haven't read it, but I've sort of read a couple of summaries. And yeah, you can see where Proyas clearly took a few elements and was inspired by a few things in that. And again, let's be honest, the Strugatsky brothers, not an influence that most filmmakers are going to cite,
Yeah. Well, and speaking of influences and the ways that things have cascaded into and out of this movie, David Goyer, you can see some of the things that he used here in Batman Begins. And with Lem Dobbs, who did the screenplay for Kafka, for Steven Soderbergh's movie that I wish that it were really easy to get your hands on this, because I think it's one of the most fascinating movies Soderbergh made, though it was a massive failure as far as he was concerned and ended up spinning him into a bit of a tailspin for a little while. The work that they did together on that film is so almost like a cousin, like a sibling to Dark City. I find it fascinating that both of those screenwriters who worked on the film could not entirely shake some of these things that just got their hooks into them.
Right. Well, and at the same time as this was being made, another movie that Lem Dobbs wrote actually was The Limey, which
one of the best movies of that decade.
Right. Right.
And, bar none.
I mean, very different to this movie, but you can kind of see, combined with Soderbergh's taste for cut up and strange juxtaposition and what have you, you can see a little bit of that. And he also wrote Haywire, which I really like. It, again, didn't do an awful lot of box office, wasn't really sort of, critically acclaimed, but I thought was actually a pretty good movie. That was the one starring the MMA fighter.
Gina Carano,
that's it. I thought that was a pretty good movie. And yeah, it turns out that was Lem Dobbs as well. But again, if you listen to the director's commentary with Proyas, one of the things he says about Lem Dobbs, the times he mentions Dobbs is when he's calling out really good and memorable lines from the movie. So I'm guessing that Dobbs has basically just got a really good ear for dialogue and, conversational exchanges. And so you can understand why a filmmaker like Soderbergh would be attracted to working with him.
He's got this amazing precision of language that especially you see in The Limey, where you only have to give Terrence Stamp as many words as he absolutely has to say.
Right.
And it's like someone else doing a soliloquy in a Shakespeare play.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, William Hurt, I feel, has that same sort of wonderful ability to say so much with just a look and a shrug. There is a wonderful, and this is very sort of, digression, but there's a wonderful quote from Anthony Horowitz, who wrote the series Foyle's War, TV series, starring Michael Kitchen. And he once said that one of the reasons he loves having Michael Kitchen in the role is that he will write pages and pages of dialogue, you know, expository dialogue and stuff, hand it to Michael Kitchen, and Michael will just run a red pen through, you know, 9/10 of it, going, I can do that with a look. It's fine. And he does. He does. He barely says anything. He just looks, raises an eyebrow, and you know exactly what he's thinking and what he wants to say. You know, I love actors who can do that. And yes, William Hurt is definitely one of those. Terrence Stamp, absolutely one of those. And yeah, as I say, again, there is a lot of dialogue in this movie, but again, there's nothing unnecessary. There's nothing that doesn't need to be said, either for the purposes of a naturalistic scene or in order for the audience to be able to, you know, another clue for the audience to add to the pile and help them piece together what's going on. As I say, nothing is wasted.
You've made multiple mentions of Alex Proyas's wonderful commentary on this, and that reminds me once again to shill for the Blu-ray DVD if you have to do DVD. This is one of the few that I have on my shelf that I know that I return to at least once a year, if not more frequently. It sometimes depends on a mood. Sometimes I find myself watching it 3 times in a month. It's a movie that just does not leave you. But another feature on there is a commentary with Roger Ebert, who was the great critical champion of this movie before it was fashionable. And his commentary does a wonderful job in a few places of pointing out just how there is not a bit of waste in this movie. And beyond there not being any waste, there's embellishment in the right sense of embellishment. You're getting more visual data in a given frame of the film than you really have to be given.
Yes.
And it fleshes out the world in ways that giving you a precise map of where everything is and showing you exactly what quadrant of things is moving how or changing how with each resetting of the game board, as it were, in ways that I'm sure for someone who wants a transactional video game narrative out of something like that, of knowing exactly what's changed where and which achievement points are where and that sort of thing. Without going to that level of specificity, you feel like you know this world so much better than you do, where these are just, you know, flats on a soundstage, you know, on the bottom of Australia. And they move a couple of things around and it's suddenly a completely different set, but it feels like another environment in this big, expansive world.
Right. And it's consistent. I mean, this is what I said earlier about the world building and the immersion, is that, yes, everything is consistent and everything is detailed, as you said. Yes, as Ebert points out, everything is filled. There's in the introduction, Ebert, who incidentally called this his best film of the year. This was Roger Ebert's best film of 1998. Just let that sink in for a moment. And in the introduction to the DVD, Ebert points out there's one particular scene where William Hurt, the detective, is talking to Jennifer Connelly's character, who is John Murdoch's wife, and they have this conversation in the inspector's office, and then they, you know, sort of finish and say goodbye, and then they move out into the sort of, you know, the wider expanse of the police precinct for two lines. There's absolute, and think how much, you know, think how much setup needed to go into that shot. And it's a big set as well. The wider precinct is a long, deep set full of this detail with like 5-6 extras all milling around playing, you know, uniform cops. Think how much setup and time it took to film that for the sake of two lines that could have easily happened in the office. Those two lines could easily have been delivered in the inspector's office just to end the scene. But instead, they move through the doorway into the wider expanse to say those two lines and give you another glimpse into the world, to sort of reaffirm where everything is. The lines take on an extra significance because of where they're being said and the sort of the way that, you know, you get the feeling of his wife, Jennifer Connelly's character, feeling completely abandoned and hopeless. And you get that from the expanse of the space that she's in rather than being in a small claustrophobic office. So little touches like that. There's so much good craft in this movie that just, again, yet got sort of brushed over because everybody said, oh, it looks great, but the story is terrible. And it's like, no, it's really not.
It's a deeply personal film for Proyas, who in John Murdoch's inserted memories drew from a number of his own personal memories of childhood and so on. But for me, the thing that, again, you know, I want to stress, I'm not for the sake of creating conflict, saying there has to be a Dark City versus the Matrix sort of thing. But because that was very much what it was at the time, it was that people were not paying attention to this smaller budgeted, much less marketed movie that had so much more heart and emotion to it than the very, I guess you would say, hermetically sealed in a plastic bag, emotionless world of the Matrix. To read just a tiny excerpt from Ebert's review, the poignancy of Dark City emerges in its love stories. At a crucial point, John Murdoch tells Emma, "Everything you remember and everything I'm supposed to remember never really happened." Emma doesn't think that can be true. "I so vividly remember meeting you," she says. "I remember falling in love with you." Yes, she remembers, but this is the first time that they have met. "I love you, John," she says. "You can't fake something like that." And Murdoch says, "No, you can't. You can inform someone who they love, and that is what the strangers have done with their memory injection. But what she feels cannot be injected. That is the part the strangers do not understand. Emma has a small role, but it is at the heart of the movie because she truly knows love. John has still to discover it and to learn about it from her." That, for me, is Ebert in a nutshell. You know, what a great critic he was, as well as what singularly makes this work stand out among not just its year, but the entirety of the 90s for me, is there is so much more heart, so much more intention, so much blood, sweat, and tears just condensed into this one film that you don't see people working or trying nearly that hard across the rest of the decade.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. Like I say, yeah, the craft and the sort of meticulous attention to detail. I mean, another thing about this movie is that it's all sets. There is no location filming in any, you know, the entire city, every street, every room, every building, everything is a set. And so everything had to be constructed from scratch with attention to detail. But think how much effort that is. You know, when you go and film on location, sure, you can dress a location, but you know, a lot of the work is done for you. The thing is already built. You know, you're going somewhere that already exists. The trees or whatever are already there. That wasn't the case here. They had to build everything, and yet it doesn't, even though, you know, sort of mild spoilers, it turns out that it has been you know, sort of built, but it doesn't feel artificial. You know, it feels, as I say, it has that lovely noir aesthetic. And yes, something's off, and you can always feel that something is a little off about the city, but it never feels fake because of this massive attention to detail and the incredible amount of work put in. And yeah, I just don't think, I agree, it doesn't get anywhere near enough credit for that. And as for the Dark City versus Matrix stuff, I always feel in 1991, there was a movie, a modern sort of movie with modern sensibilities about Robin Hood that hit cinema screens. And it was a wonderful movie, well acted, well produced. And unfortunately, it opened 3 weeks before Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And it just got slammed. It's the one I'm talking about starred Patrick Bergin, Uma Thurman, Jürgen Prochnow, Jerome Crabb. I mean, this is not, you know, an unknown cast. And it just got absolutely slammed because it opened shortly before Prince of Thieves, and Prince of Thieves just hammered it at the box office. And, you know, it's inevitable. You know that I'm going to say that it was a far, far superior movie to Prince of Thieves. And it's kind of the, you know, I always feel the same way here. I mean, this wasn't the same year as The Matrix, but Dark City was.
It was out a year before, even though they were shooting rather simultaneously.
Right, but it didn't get anywhere near the push and press promotion and stuff that The Matrix did. It didn't test well, so the studio were a bit, you know, clearly didn't want to put too much money into promoting it in this strange backwards logic that they have. And so it did not exactly sink without trace, but it was not a sort of a common widespread pop culture moment in the way that The Matrix was. And The Matrix just, you know, is there anyone on the planet who doesn't know what The Matrix is? Whereas, you could probably say the inverse about Dark City. You know, is there anyone on the planet left who does know what Dark City is? And it's such a shame.
I'd like to pivot to Alex Proyas himself. And I think that maybe the studio considered him a little bit difficult to work with. He was asking for more money. He was asking for more shooting weeks. But he was coming off of directing The Crow, where his star was killed on camera.
Right.
And I... You know, there's not supposed to be any heart or emotion in the studio world. It's all robotic, you know, assembly line making of things. But I would have liked to think that they would have cut him a little bit of slack and given him a little bit more room to breathe, because they had lunch for more than they probably spent on the reshoots for Dark City. And it was another 4 years after Dark City before he would make his next movie, Garage Days, which barely anybody saw. And then he went on to make iRobot with Will Smith. I think that one maybe would have done better with a Will Smith theme song. Who knows? Then we got Knowing in 2009, and then most recently Gods of Egypt, which was massively slammed for having an incredibly white cast playing the gods of Egypt.
Well, and let's face it, Knowing didn't exactly get glowing reviews either.
Not really. And Knowing was one of those ones that I'm more positive on it than I think some of my friends are. It's no Dark City.
I would say Knowing is an interesting movie, but not necessarily one that I could recommend.
Yeah, and I feel like it's sad to say, oh, well, someone peaked in 1998. There are worse things to do than to make something that I really consider an underloved, underappreciated masterpiece that early in your feature directing career.
Right. If you're going to peak, then peaking with The Crow and Dark City is not bad. You know? But yes, I agree. Proyas has been kind of troubled ever since, certainly ever since this movie. And I do, yes, I get the impression that he is both sort of picky, you know, fastidious, and not particularly easy to work with. From a studio point of view, I mean, I haven't heard anything negative about him from, you know, sort of the crew or actors or whatever, but from the sort of the production and the studio point of view, yeah, you very much get the impression that he's not somebody that people are falling over themselves to have direct their next blockbuster, which is a shame because, yeah, The Crow, I mean, good Lord, you know, The Crow, what a fantastic, low-budget, massive success movie, you know, that did spawn a franchise. Obviously based on the comic book. Maybe people don't know that, but, yes, famously based on a comic book by James O'Barr. And, yes, most infamous, unfortunately, for the death of Brandon Lee. It was a stunt gun, I think, that went wrong. It was a
stunt gun that was loaded with actual live ammunition instead of blanks, and
it
instituted safety concerns that are there to this day, and that his name is referenced in the.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
For me, it's one of the reasons that I find myself saying, "Well, let's have some sympathy for Alex Proyas, who doesn't always do himself favors with posting things online or giving interviews about how people should have been there for Dark City when it came out, and the critics should have realized its unparalleled genius and that sort of thing. You know, he's not exactly helping himself out by blaming other people for not recognizing him or appreciating him enough. But I feel like a lot of the pain that I think that's born out of really comes out of being part of one of the signature tragedies of modern cinema, where that absolutely shouldn't have happened. And it's not the sort of thing that many other directors have really gone through. You know, you had John Landis with the Twilight Zone movie, which was another pile of safety concerns that someone should have had to deal with. But it undoubtedly affected his career from then on, just in the exact same way that it visibly has Alex Proyas. So what else do we have for Dark City? Have we fully re-sculpted the city into a form that you like, Anthony?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, and I realize for people who haven't seen the movie, we have been quite vague about some things, but that's deliberate. Like I say, I want people really to... I don't know if it's available on streaming. I imagine it is. You know, I want people to go and find this movie and watch it if they have never seen it, because, in my opinion, you are missing out on a sort of minor modern sci-fi classic. And so that's why I have been, you know, a little deliberately vague with some of the details because I don't want to give too much away. Part of the joy, much as I enjoy rewatching the movie, and I genuinely do, but part of the joy of watching a movie like this for the first time is, like I said at the start, being dropped in media res, having no idea what's going on and having to figure it out, having to pay attention, pick up on all the clues and figure things out as the characters do, at the, you know, alongside the characters. But again, like I said, the one thing I can assure you about this movie is that you will be rewarded. Everything matters. Everything is a clue and everything fits together at the end. You know, it's not one of those where you put it, you sort of start following the clues and then you get to the revelation. You're like, wait a second, that doesn't make sense. No, everything here makes sense. It is so well crafted. And so, yeah, I really urge people to go and give this movie another chance.
Can I assume that your recommendation to everyone is to seek out the director's cut?
I would say so, but as we said before, if the theatrical cut is the only one you can see, it's still really good. You know, it's not, this is not like Blade Runner or something where I would never suggest people see the theatrical cut if they can, if they have the opportunity to see the director's cut. Which I know some people will disagree with me on, but that's me. I am, you know, a big old Blade Runner fanboy, and I do love the director's cut. Whereas this, I think the director's cut is better, but if you only have the chance to see the theatrical cut, don't pass it up because of that, because it is still a great movie. Like I say, it's still the movie that I first fell in love with, lo, these many years ago.
Yet another unsponsored plug for the Blu-ray. One of the interesting features on it for the director's cut is a kind of a trivia fact track with little pop-up notes about scenes that have been changed, things that have been moved around,
things
that have been altered. One of my favorite things is that they restored Jennifer Connelly's singing voice in the movie, where she was overdubbed in the theatrical cut. For what reason, I don't know, having heard her original vocals on the director's cut now. There are a number of changes that it boggles the mind. The studio executive who actually sent in the notes to have him change certain things or add certain things in, that really, when you look at the director's cut, they just weren't necessary. It doesn't fundamentally destroy the movie, but it feels like the, not necessarily death of a thousand cuts, but maybe the maiming of a thousand cuts.
It's change for the sake of change. It's people justifying their jobs, I think. I mean, it's a bit like Lizette Anthony being dubbed in Krull. You know, why? She has a perfectly fine voice. She just doesn't have an American accent, you know. And Proyas, again, touches on this in the director's commentary and says he has a feeling. And bearing in mind, obviously, as you said, Proyas is a bit prickly about people not recognizing his genius. But nevertheless, he says that he has a feeling, he had a feeling at the time that this was, because the movie didn't test well, therefore people went looking for things to change that they thought, you know, might be wrong with it. And maybe that was one of them. I mean, yeah, her voice, she doesn't have the strongest singing voice in the world. You know, you can hear it in the director's cut, but it's fine. She can carry a tune. You know, there's nothing wrong with it.
It's nothing like Natalie Wood in West Side Story, which was just atrocious.
I'm actually not familiar with that, but I'll take your word for it.
Oh boy. It's a bad one. Yeah. If you want to seek something out on YouTube, there's a great comparison to make. That's back in the age when they did absolutely have to overdub actresses who couldn't really carry a tune.
Right. Well, and you know, I'm sure some people still can't, but Jennifer Connelly can. So yes,
yeah.
There's really no need to overdub it, except that, as I say, you know, Proyas, I mean, he doesn't reference that specifically, but he says that he had a feeling that because the movie didn't test well and audiences were bored stroke confused, that the studio were basically just looking for things that they could change that they thought might make a difference. But one of the things he mentions there, and I think this is a good point to go out on, because I try to live by this principle myself as a creator. He mentions the dangers of trying to make something mass appeal at the cost of watering it down so much that you lose appeal to the people who would otherwise love your movie. And he cites The Crow, naturally, as a great example of that, where he didn't compromise and The Crow was absolutely, you know, made to be aimed at its natural audience without any compromise to make it more accessible to a wide audience. And it succeeded both in attracting that core audience. And because of that, because of their enthusiasm for it, it did spread out. It did touch the mainstream and the mass audience to an extent anyway, certainly more probably than it would have done if it had been watered down, because then nobody would like it. You know, the mass audience would say, well, that's too weird. And the weirdos would say, that's too mass audience. And he feels that that's kind of what they risked with this, with the theatrical cut. Like I say, I disagree with him because I think the theatrical cut is still a very good movie. But that is a very real danger when you're making, especially genre stuff, but anything at all that's a kind of a personal project and maybe a bit strange, maybe a bit odd, there is always a temptation to not necessarily dumb it down, you know, that's a very loaded term, but to make something less weird, to file the hard edges down so that it will appeal to more of a mass audience. But you always run the risk that the mass audience still won't go for it. And now you've also completely lost your core audience who wanted something with sharp edges and that was weird and strange and a bit confusing. And so, yeah, I always try to follow that principle myself and, you know, sort of follow my instincts on that score. I would rather make something that is loved by 100 people than seen by 1,000 who all go, meh. And I think this is one of those movies. It's not for everyone, sure. But if you are the sort of person who likes movies like the ones I've described and like the way I've described this movie, then I think this is a movie for you. And you are that core audience that Proyas was trying to reach.
Anthony, if there's a mass audience of 100 who'd like to love you or 1,000 who'd like to see you, where can they find you?
They can find me, well, right here, obviously. On Twitter, I am Anthony Johnston, AntonyJohnston. Or my website is the same, AnthonyJohnston.com.
I'm Moises Chu Yan. I run Electric Shadow Network, ESN.FM. I'm on Twitter at Moises Chu, MoisesChiu. You can follow this show, Unjustly Maligned, at UMPFM. And this has been a 7RQ production for The Incomparable in England by way of Texas.
Well done. Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at AnthonyJohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at UMP.FM. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I was acting in a student short film at Florida State University when I was in college, and we had a stunt gun that fired stunt blanks, and I was the one operating it, and I went through kind of a mini workshop for how I was going to handle it, how it was going to be checked before it was put into my hand, whose hand I was going to put it precisely into once they yelled cut, and how it was going to be stored and how it was going to be checked each time it was brought back out, and that sort of thing. And the safety guy specifically said, and the reason that we're doing this is because of a guy named Brandon Lee, who is dead and shouldn't be dead because someone didn't do their job. And because we did not have regulations that were nearly this strict, you know, back in the day. And it was nice that the Florida State film school had the kind of budget that could pay for a guy like that. But I wonder about the many, many film sets that are threadbare, you know, tiny little productions that that don't even have that kind of budget to put that sort of safety into things. But it is something that absolutely reverberates through to now.
Absolutely, yeah. And as it should, you know, for heaven's sake, the man was an actor and he died because, yeah, as you say, somebody else didn't do his job. It's not like he was a frontline soldier or something. He, you know, had no expectation of being shot when he went to work that day. It's, we could all do with, you know, more of that, frankly, in many others. Look at the whole Sarah Jones the Safety for Sarah movement.
Yeah.
You know, which is obviously kind of a modern incarnation of that sort of thing. I mean, that wasn't specifically about a single, you know, practice like, yeah, you know, gun firing blanks or whatever, but has become a thing for the same reason. It's like she was a crew member. She did not wake up that morning going to work thinking, oh, I might get killed today. It's so, yeah, I'm glad that there is now much more of a focus on gun safety because of Brandon Lee. You know, if something good can come out of that tragedy, then thank goodness. But that's one of the things I love about... I've forgotten his name. The Dark Knight director, the guy, the Inception guy.
Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan.
I think you'll have your
British citizenship revoked for forgetting Christopher Nolan's name, for God's sake.
We'll cut this out.